Quaxkina, welcome everybody. My name is Alexandre Nicuado. I'm here with my colleague André Dumen, and this week our guest is Kawenati. If you can introduce yourself, Kawenati.
Certainly. Sego sewo guego, Kawenati ni waxanoda. I am originally from Gahnawage near Montreal. I am a Ganyangehaga or Mohawk, and I'm a contemporary artist.
Welcome, Kawenati, on Adadagan Street. Yeah, you must feel at home. This is a Mohawk name, brand new Mohawk name for an old Mohawk territory. And so we are very proud to have contributed, actually, to the toponymic change of the street and to have chosen this emblematic name for our podcast. And wow, you fit exactly in you are the good person in the good place. Especially that we are webcasting this podcast. So welcome. Well, I see you when I am really going back in the 90s, where what we can call the actual contemporary art movement, indigenous contemporary art movement, started. And I remember with Arthur Lamotte, we went to Ottawa to film Indigena, an art exhibition at the National Gallery with Gerald McMaster that was there. It was the really the beginning. And for many, many people, it was astonishing. What? Indigenous contemporary art. Nobody in the mind of many people, and not only public, but in the mind of the critics of the art milieu, it was impossible to connect for many people indigenous and modern art. And I want to start there because many young people, like Alexandre, may think that what we see now, indigenous artists in museums and galleries everywhere, that it is the normality that has been there for long. No, it's brand new. And so can you speak of you at this fantastic, but at the same time, difficult period, the 90s.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, it's so nice to talk about that, actually. I haven't talked about that very often over the years. At that moment, so Indigena, trying to think of what I was doing, I think in 1992, I was doing a graduate diploma here at Concordia University. I had done my fine arts degree, my bachelor's degree already, and got out of university and got really afraid because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what kind of job I could get. So I went back to school. And so I'm trying to tell you, I graduated from Concordia from my fine arts degree, I think, or one of those degrees. Or diploma, and when I was at Concordia, I had joined the student group called AFNC, Assembly of First Nations Concordia, which is funny. I'm laughing, and I think you know it's because, of course, there was the Assembly of First Nations, the national organization, but we weren't like a spinoff or anything. We just didn't think of a better name, I guess. And there was artists in that group. There was Ryan Rice, Eric Robertson, Arthur Renwick, Varan Pardeatan, and Mary Longman. And I hope I'm not forgetting anyone, but those folks were in my cohort. So we were meeting together regularly. We all took a trip up north to Robert Otterize's territory. And so we were quite a nice, cohesive group of we became friends. And so when we graduated, Ryan, Eric, and I decided to start an artist collective called Nation to Nation. We wanted to make sure, so I said this already, we were contemporary artists, right? And we joined together because we wanted to keep producing work and exhibiting work. And we very clearly did not think we would be exhibited in any galleries around. We didn't think we'd be exhibited in either the artist-run centers nor the museums or you know, bigger galleries. And so, you know, but we saw things happening. Like, so in 1990, of course, was the siege of Gunasadage, or the Oka crisis, as it's both, they're known by both things now. You know, we saw Indigena happening. We saw the Spirit Sings happening. And we saw Nouveau Territoire here in Montreal. I believe those two were 1992 was both Indigena and Nouveau Territoire.
I think Nouveau Territoire was maybe a few years before, anyway.
Okay.
I am not sure, too. Anyway. It was in those times, anyway.
Yes, it was early 90s, all of that. So, yeah, and I think it was, we just kept making that work, not knowing, how can I say, I'll talk for myself, you know, I wasn't thinking about breaking into galleries. I was thinking about making work and supporting the community, like being supported by the community, but also like creating these moments. Like our Nation to Nation events were so amazing, if I do say so myself. The first one we had was called A Celebration of Art. And Eric Robertson was at that time seeing Michelle Thrush, who has since become a famous actress. And at this time, she had written a performance, a one-woman performance that she wanted to show. And we had some art. And now Eric had this beautiful loft in Old Montreal where it was actually still cheap for art. You know, artists could live there cheaply. And so we drew a little invitation and we photocopied it and we handed it out to some people. And over 100 people showed up that night to look at our work and to see Michelle's performance. And then we impromptu had an open mic, and we couldn't believe the people who got up. We didn't even know them. And they said poetry and they, you know, Arthur sang and played his guitar. And it was just this incredible evening. We had food and we just knew we were doing something right. And we had almost a similar thing happened when we did our show called Native Love, where we invited, you know, and felt like we invited a few people. We didn't know who would come. And many, many people showed up in this super obscure location where we were lent somebody's office space in the Nordelec building. Now it's condos, but it was like a gigantic building of offices, you know, at that time. So yeah, that's what I mean by sort of supporting each other. Like that was the times when if there was a Native art event, I was there. Like, you know, I just showed up to everything, but there wasn't that many things. In contrast to now, you know, where there's so much happening all the time. I'm like, I actually can't attend everything anymore, you know, and it's wonderful. It's really great that that's happening. But yeah,
I remember also of Art Bingo,
the installation
organized. I was there.
Yes.
And Bordelot, he was there, the Cree guy, and he was so excited. I was like, ah! And he won the big prize. I was so angry. I wanted to win.
Yeah, you play bingo, you win art, we said. Yeah, that was another one. That was our first fundraiser, but we didn't raise that much money. We rented the bingo machine. We got t-shirts made. Yeah, that was too bad for us, but it was a fun event and you still remember it. And a lot of people walked away with a lot of original art that night.
And also, already, I think, in your own parcours, your own way, you were already in this non-worldly, putting down boundaries between arts and life, and between artists, normal or alpha human being, and that lambda human beings. So it's interesting because very rapidly, and you were certainly at the vanguard, you went to have activities on cyberspace, on the web, and it was just the beginning of the web in the 90s. So how come you make this, well, now it seems natural, but at this time it was a big jump in the unknown, brand new web world. And I am wondering, how come you make this huge step?
Well, you know, I don't, it's a little bit mysterious to me too, in a way. When I was at Concordia, there was a course called Computer as a Design Tool. So yes, that's exactly what we're talking about. Like, now everyone thinks that designers use computers to design, but and you know, my first year going in, we were still using repeatograph pens, French curves, you know, mechanical pencils. There was no computers, except that suddenly, or yeah, I don't know about suddenly, but I mean, eventually or soon, the design art department got these cute little boxes, Apple IIe's, right? And we had a class. Computer as a Design Tool was a class, and it showed us HyperCard, which is the precursor to the web. It was about linking files together and being able to click on a link and go to another file. So that happened. And then they also got these other computers called Amigas. And these Amiga computers were really about, this was before Photoshop. So there was a program called DigiPaint, and you could take a picture of someone. How did it work? Anyway, basically you could do Photoshop before Photoshop, very rudimentary version of it. And I was just fascinated by this. I loved it. I felt like I could do things that I wasn't able to do before. Like, my drawing was okay, but I wanted something very realistic, and this was able to offer that to me, you know. I remember I did a series of pictures called Lovers, Tongue Tied and Tied to the Tongue. It's a lyric from a song by the Jesus and Mary Chain. But what I did is I took pictures of my friends sticking their tongues out at each other in different ways. And then I used the tools to attach the tongues and make the tongue into a big bow or into a knot. So they were tied together, you know? So that's what I mean when I say, like, I could get this realistic image, and it was different than drawing it. So the big thing that happened, which is a story that I do tell a lot, is after I graduated, I was attending. So in addition to Nation to Nation, I was also, I started to get into the artist run centers. I got an internship at Obero Gallery and Studio XX, which has now got a different name, which I think is Ada, but I'm sorry if I miss saying that. But Studio XX existed, and they were a place to teach. They were a production place for women to learn about technology. So they would have these evenings called Wired Women or Femme Branchée, where they would demonstrate new technologies. And one night they demonstrated the Palace. And the Palace was something so cutting edge. It was a chat room, which wasn't brand new. That was like, I mean, it was relatively new, but, you know, not a lot of people knew what they were, but they were text-based little windows that you would open, and you would be able to talk to people real time, you know, immediately anywhere in the world by texting. Well, what the Palace did is they took that technology and they made it visual. They made it image-based. And so the rooms now look like little rooms with like some chairs in there, or different kinds of rooms. And you were represented by this thing called an avatar. And here you were, this little happy face that could move around by pushing the arrow keys. And when you typed, oh, your words came out in a little balloon like a cartoon. And I fell in love. I don't know what it was about it, but I just I wanted to be there. I wanted to be in this palace place. I was in there every day talking to other people about anything. You know, it wasn't about native art or art. It was just about life, you know, making all kinds of friends, but always new friends. Like I think there were a few people that I would see regularly, but it was just like a party all the time. That's how it felt to me.
Was it in 2D?
Yes, completely 2D. Yes, you're just moving. This is my avatar, you know. And eventually, the palace, what I loved about it too, very user-friendly, I thought. It was a very big deal for some people to download the client software. This was not like whatever this thing is. I can't remember the name of your beautiful software. Yes. You know, it was not web-based at all. And I think that was a barrier for some people. But anyway, what I'm trying to get at is the palace wanted other people to create more palaces. And this started, like, they would sort of advertise that, or they would talk about that. And I started to think how great it would be to have a palace for Indigenous people. How there's so many of us. Now I was starting to meet other contemporary artists, you know, besides Ryan and like us who were in Montreal. They were actually, they're all over Turtle Island, you know. And remember back then you had to pay for long distance calls, you know, and it was expensive to talk to people on the phone. But this was free. Of course, you needed a computer, you needed a modem, you needed all this stuff. But it, you know, I had access through Obero, and I started to think about how other people could get access. And I'm really trying to compress this story because it really took a very long time, but basically figured out that I should and wanted to and did create my own palace called Cyber Powwow with the help of Nation to Nation, with the help of other Indigenous artists. And we started to have these gatherings. We found other places in North America and beyond who had computers and modems. And we connected up and we invited people to come in as Nation to Nation always had. We had food and we made sure that people would sit down and I'd say, look, you just press the arrow key. Look, that's your avatar. Look, that's you. Put your name. Oh, look, now you're moving around. Say something. Oh, that's what you said. And showed them how to use it, you know.
But also the cyber power space was a place for arts too. The mm-hmm. people were creating text and images too. So it was a cyber gallery in a sense.
It was not even in a sense. Like today, that's like, yes, it was a gallery. And today people are talking about cyber powwow. They're recognizing it in a way they didn't when it came out as one of the first galleries on. So it was definitely the first Indigenous online gallery. And it was one of the first galleries, online galleries at the time.
So you were a pioneer without knowing it.
Yes.
Isn't it different?
Yes, thanks to different, like, yes, thanks to Abtech and my partner, Jason Lewis, we have kept the Nation to Nation and Cyber Powwow websites up all this time, even though you can't quite see everything. What happens when you click on gallery, Alexandre? Yeah, so you can see, you can visit some remnants of the artworks that were in there, but at least we have all the artists who participated here. And it tells you if the work was a web-based work or a palace-based work. And yeah, there were four iterations. We started off asking a question similar to what you just asked me earlier, Andre, like, you know, can Indigenous art, can, and of course we were Native then, you know, or First Nations, can First Nations artists be authentic if they make digital art? You know, and the answer was, of course we can. You know, but it was a question.
Yes, again, we have to go back in that time. I remember Virginia Pessimateo Bordelot told me that, well, a friend of her who was a non-native artist, recognized, told her, you know, when I use feathers, I am still doing contemporary art. But if you use aluminium, as an Aboriginal, you are still doing traditional non-contemporary art because you are Aboriginal. That's incredible, but it was the general speech at this period.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also another things that were expressed by the Aboriginal artists, and it was out of this uncertainty. They were often telling, and it was also creating a kind of inner distance between Aboriginal artists, because they were many avant-garde artists were telling, well, I am an artist first, and I happen to be Aboriginal, but it's not that important. And I think you never adhere to that speech.
No, I mean, I think I mostly, there. I mean, I think I questioned all of it. I think over the years, I tried all kinds of different identities on. I don't want to, I mean, that's a weird, I got to be careful how I say that. I've always been Mohawk. I've never hidden that fact. I've always been proud to be Mohawk, but I have wondered, you know, for example, when I was hired, but at the Banff Center, I was one of the first recipients of the then very new grant, which was called, I think it was called Indigenous Curators Grant or something. And like, you know, they made me a card, and on, you know, we were trying to decide if the card should say Indigenous Curator or not. And I was like, well, it's so weird. Like, actually, the other curators don't have to put their, you know, white curator or Italian curator or something, you know, so maybe not, I said, you know. So, you know, so that was one time, you know, one time that I sort of took it away. But just, yeah, I just wanted to see if it just didn't seem to make sense in the context of everything. You know, on my bio originally, I used to say my entire, you know, I used to say, I am the daughter of a Mohawk woman and an Italian immigrant father, a Mohawk mother and an Italian immigrant father. Like, I felt like I gave my genealogy for so long. And then finally, I was like, you know, other people don't have to do that. I don't think I'm going to put that anymore. You know, and by that time, though, I was using my name Skawanadi, because, you know, you've known me, Andre, since I was Trisha Fragnito, you know, so now I'm using just Skawanadi. And I have in my bio, like, so many things that indicate that I'm Indigenous, like that I was a member of the Quebec Native Women's Association, that I don't know, I had this show or that show, you know, so I sort of slowly took out the kind of some of the details. But anyway, so yeah, I don't know.
It seems for me that in cities, it's important to show where you come from. But who your mothers are, your parents are. But for us, I think I would only say I come from Manwan. No need to say I'm a Tikamek from Manwan. I just say I come from Manwan. So people will know that I'm probably a Tikamek.
Yeah, what I've noticed now, right now, in the last couple of years, I have noticed people are saying, my mother was Brenda Deerhouse. Her parents were, like, I've noticed people really putting their genealogy into their bios, which is like, so I don't know, you know, I think we're trying things. We're just experimenting with stuff and figuring out what works best for each of us individually, but also us as a collective, the collective of Indigenous people, you know?
Well, but when you present yourself at the beginning, you told us, I am from Ganawagi. And I think this notion of connection to a land or to a territory or to community is important. And then it makes the links for the author web initiative, which is, I have to remember, Indigenous Spaces on Cyberspace. Can you speak about it? It was like the continuation of Cyber Power.
You mean Aboriginal territories in cyberspace? Yes, right. Yes, it very much was the continuation of cyberpower in many ways. I mean, just the name itself, if you know, on the website, you might have noticed, like it said, Cyber Powwow, an Aboriginal territory in cyberspace. That's what we were trying to do. We were trying to start to stake a claim, kind of like a land claim, but in virtual territory. And so when Jason Lewis and I were first able to apply for a grant to do something, the grant was a pilot project from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council called Aboriginal Research Networks. And we were like, well, we've created a network with Cyber Powwow. We have a big network. And so we decided to call the grant Aboriginal Territories in Cyberspace, ABTEC. And we were very clear of what we wanted to do. We had lived together in San Francisco during the big tech bubble. We knew a lot of the people, a lot of the indigenous people who were kind of embracing this technology, you know, and we thought, this is a really important moment for us as indigenous people, because I hesitate to say never, but with certain technologies, you know, indigenous people could not get their hands on them at the same time as white people. So we always talk about the fact that white men, you know, had cameras and took pictures of us and then told their stories about us. Now everybody was getting the web at the same time. We were there at the ground floor along with white people and other people. And we thought it was very important that we make sure that that our presence was there. Présence autochtone in cyberspace, you know. So we started doing, so we certainly started this network. We gathered a bunch of people together and we talked about what were some of the things we could do together and how should we do it. And I remember very clearly, I'm trying to think of her name now, this wonderful storyteller from up north. You know her too. Oh my goodness. She's from the Yukon. Beautiful woman with long dark hair all the time. Anyway, her name will come to me in a moment. But she said, we have to reach the youth and we have to reach them where they are and they're playing video games. So you need to make some indigenous video games. And we were like, oh, we don't know how to do that. That's not quite what we were thinking. But we did it. We started to do it. And that's how we started the Skins program. Skins workshops in Aboriginal storytelling and experimental digital media. And that program is going on today. And we've been invited all over the place. It's been amazing. We've been invited to Hawaii, to Regina, to Val-d'Or. We're going up to Nemiska in a couple of weeks. We're going to New Zealand. We've been asked to do a machinima workshop. That's what I do. So yeah, it's really been a wonderful program.
When I see the short of Time Traveler, I think it's a good example of indigenous avatar moving in that surreal surroundings of the web. And maybe because I am old, but it took me back in the 70s, where there was this movement by the Black Warriors. Black is beautiful. And there was a lot of arts and posters to show the beauty of the Black persons instead of the look, opposing the look that comes from the outside. And also, it was moving images, and we know how we have been caricatured as peoples in the cinema, especially American cinema, but it is the one that has spread this kind of images all over the place and all over the world, and in our own minds too. So it was interesting to see that it was image building to exercise. And also, I won't say an easy one, but certainly easier than to do feature movies.
Well, yes. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love Machinima is it's pretty DIY, do it yourself, you know? But there's a lot of reasons why I chose to. I mean, I think you're talking about the fact that I'm making movies in virtual environments right now. So I should just explain the term because I don't think I did yet. But a machinima is a movie made in a virtual environment, like a video game. A lot of people know the machinima Red versus Blue, which is made in the Halo video game. But a lot of people are making movies in Minecraft because it's such a customizable environment. I make my movies in Second Life, which is also a customizable environment, which looks more realistic, if you will. I mean, it doesn't look like... I don't feel this is telling us very much, this picture. I don't like the Wikipedia definition of machinima.
Yeah.
You could show them Time Traveler TM. Why don't you play one of the episodes while we talk? You don't have to play the sound. And so I had this story I wanted to tell. I have these skins workshops just beginning, and we're trying to figure out what we can teach what is the curriculum that we can build. Certainly we can build a video game curriculum, you know, using a game engine and teaching them how to model their own characters. But maybe we want to show them how to tell stories in this slightly easier medium, like where the characters are already made for you, like you just have to customize them. You can just change their eye color. You could, you know, you can give them new hair, give them costumes. So when I saw Second Life, I was just, again, it was like the palace. First of all, it was like the palace on so many levels. You could talk to people. You had an avatar. Now it wasn't just a smiley face. It was a whole body. It moved in 3D, not just 2, you know. Did I already say it was customizable? I think I said it 5 times, but yeah, you know, you could do all this stuff. And so I had this story I had written for another project, and I really wanted to find a way to tell the story. And it was about a man who lived in the future, who had a jetpack. And I was like, I can't do a live action version of this. I don't know how to do that. I am not a movie maker. I've never made films, you know, how. You know, I could probably try, but I knew it would take millions of dollars and like lots of people. But this here you are, here you enter Second Life, and your avatar already has the ability to walk, run, and fly. All I had to do was put a jetpack on his back and press the F button, and he was flying, you know? And of course, I felt like Second Life was a very futuristic medium. Second Life was built, the mythology goes that this guy read a book called Snow Crash, which describes a place called the Metaverse. And he said, I want to build that. And he made Second Life. And so to me, Second Life, so futuristic, you know, like already, like it's futuristic because of its pedigree or its heritage coming from this cyberpunk novel. It's futuristic because we're in an online space talking to people in real time, networked over the internet. You know, it's futuristic because of how it looks, you know, like a video game. And so I thought what I wanted to do at this point, what I wanted strongly to do was illustrate, visualize Indigenous people in the future. By now, it was very clear to me that this was something I was uniquely positioned to do. You know, I wanted to make contemporary art. I loved science fiction. And I wondered a lot about why we weren't there in the future. And so I just started this project, and I sort of have never stopped that project. I keep doing different things that are like that. I joke, but it's not a joke. It's really not a joke at all. I say to people, you can say almost anything about Native people and add in the future, and it hasn't been done yet. Like, we have so much work to do. Regalia of the future, you know, powwow of the future, These are all kinds of things that we can start to think about and imagine. Who do we want to be in the future? What values do we want to take from our past and bring to the future?
Wow. And I was wondering, I understand that you as artist has been recognized at the point, but you had there was two challenges. First, you were not at all hiding your identity, indigenous identity. And second, you were using popular culture items, video games, the bingos, powwows, everything that was not very trendy in the galleries, and how the recognition came finally. And you were also doing things in collaboration. You were not there with a specific signature of on the material works. So you were on complete outdoor path from the museums or the institutions of contemporary arts.
Yeah, pretty much, I guess so. I mean, I've never been strategic. I'm trying to get more strategic as I get older, but I've never tried to, I never said, I'm gonna do it a different way and still reach the place. I didn't even have a goal, actually, far goal. I didn't say, I want to be in the National Gallery one day. I just wanted to make art. And I definitely love showing it to people. But that was happening through Nation to Nation, you know, and slowly over time, you know, people were interested enough like that. And well, the other thing that happens that you don't realize is going to happen is your peers start to have power too. So your peers become curators and gallery directors and all this. And they are like, oh, I know, I've known Scawinati for so long, and she's been doing this kind of work. And I think it would be very interesting to put that in the gallery. So that starts to happen, you know, so like that's cool, you know. And then, well, I mean, honestly, so a couple of, you know, yeah, it's really that. Like in, you know, at Obero, I worked with someone named Sylvie Fortin, and she became the artistic director of the Montreal Biennale. And I think she suggested my name to the curators. I was Time Traveler TM was shown in that big show. And to me, that was really like my first big level up. I mean, I'd been showing at Artisan Centers a lot, like a good amount. Well, it's an okay amount. But that was like, then I started to get invitations from a lot of different places to show that work. And then, you know, slowly to make new work. And then in really, I feel during COVID, something happened where with Black Lives Matter, I think that translated here as, here in Canada, I mean, as people really wanted to collect non-white artists. So like definitely Black artists, but also Indigenous artists. And because of COVID, people were suddenly interested in digital art, more interested because there was all these online galleries and all this, everything was online. And so I was in this amazing moment with this, my Venn diagram was like, you know, Indigenous artist and digital artist. And so I think that was very, I got a lot of requests and invitations at that time too.
Yes, and I saw somewhere in your bio that even the Museum of Contemporary Arts of Montreal had some of your work. But this is very recent because I remember it's not maybe 10 years ago. Maybe I don't remember exactly, but this exhibition coming from Vancouver Red Nation, they were coming and it was collective exhibition that was that the new direction, because the older one wouldn't have taken that risk, but there was a new direction at the museum, and they took this exhibition to display in Montreal. But it, one of the conditions of getting the expo shown in another city than Vancouver was to have works with local indigenous artists to be part of the show. And they say, well, we will look in our reserve and we will show some Quebec Aboriginal artists. It's okay. And they sang and everything was going well. But when they look in the reserves, they find zero work from an Aboriginal artist. And then it was a good lesson for them because they say, well, we have now to make some acquisition because already there was national and international recognition of several of our artists that were now famous, and there was nothing in Montreal at the museum. That means a big step forward. And I don't know if you share this. I always remember Rebecca Belmore when the inauguration of his show facing the Monumental. And I think she was the first one at museum in Montreal to have a solo exhibition, the Contemporary Arts Museum. And I told her, oh, Rebecca, that's fantastic. Look at that. We are now in the big place. That was closed. That seemed a fortress that's so far away. And now you are there with solo exhibition. It's really a great, great step forward and needs an opening from the arts institution. She told me, yes, Andre, but for how long?
Yeah.
So I wonder that it can stop at the moment. For me, it's a big concern when I see the women's rights in the United States that are just falling apart. And I said, wow, something we had believed won forever. And so since Rebecca told me that, it's always somewhere behind my head, and it popped up often. And I said, wow, we are living in a good period, but will it last?
Yep, I asked that too. We've been the flavor of the week a few times, right? After 1990, there was the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples that came out in 92. And that was like, it seemed like everyone was thinking about Indigenous people, but not really everybody was. But anyway, there was a lot of work done at that time. And that was very good work, I think. Then the Truth and Reconciliation TRC Commission came out. And that was what, 2018? No, 2016? No.
2016.
2016, yeah. You know, and I felt like it repeated a lot of the stuff from the RCAP, but I felt like a lot more people heard it. I really do. I feel like, you know, I think I do feel that the younger generations are really tuned in to Indigenous issues. And I like that a lot. But yeah, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? You know, I've definitely felt that way a lot. Like I've said the same thing as Rebecca, like, oh, how long is this going to last, you know? But at the same time, I'm trying to get away from having a scarcity mentality, you know, trying to think like it's going to continue. I'd rather feel that way, you know, always save for a rainy day, but definitely just work without too much worry, you know. Anything can end at any moment. Anything. Your life can end. Your job can end. You know, like, so it's just like, just enjoy the moment. Save a little bit or like prepare in some ways, but there's no point in worrying.
And also the future is ours to build too. So
yes.
We have to keep on working and fighting. Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
So correction. Truth and Reconciliation was dissolved in 2015, from 2008 to 2015.
Okay.
Thank you.
And also, we know that you have no boundaries around you, and you never made boundaries between your engagement, your, I would say, being a militant as Indigenous woman, and your art, your involvement in art.
Well, thank you. I like being called a militant. It's not in my bio. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think it's important to, I mean, Andre, we've known each other for so long. You know, I think we've been doing such similar work for so long. We've been on committees together. We've shown up at events together. You know, we've both been at events, same events for so long in the city. I'm not even sure what I'm trying to tell you, say. It's just like, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done. And I'm happy to, I'm a little bit tired, but I'm also still very motivated, you know? And I think I was more of an activist in a way, like more of what we traditionally think of as an activist. Like when I was younger, like I was a nuclear disarmament activist. I don't know if you know that, but like, you know, I would talk to people. I organized marches. I did like this kind of activism, you know, but I found it very tiring, and it is very tiring. And slowly I started to think of my art as slow motion activism, you know, that it's hopefully going to change some people's minds or open their minds. You know, I don't want to force people to do anything, you know, but I think that putting some images and ideas out there can help people maybe move forward in a direction that I think is good, you know, and that is like to a more just world, a more even playing field where all of us can be who we want to be safely and, you know, reach our self-actualization, you know? Yeah.
Yes, and this, I should say that this kind of optimism, but active optimist, is, we can see it through your work, right? It's that many, well, it's normal, many artists have dark look at the reality, but your works are colorful, are funny, we are happy when we finish the video, so that's good. Actually, it helps us to going on what we have to do to have a better future.
Yeah. Thank you, Nyawa.
Yeah. Also, you told me you just came back from San Francisco. So this is brand new. Can you speak about it?
Yes. I'm like dying to talk. I'm like so thrilled about this project. It's called They Sustain Us. And it is the story of how the three sisters, our beloved personifications of corn, beans, and squash, as we know, became superheroes. And I started to have this idea actually around like a long time ago, like maybe 2018 or possibly earlier, of depicting them as superheroes. And it's like, wow, no one has done this before? Like, this is really obvious. Somebody has to do it. And I want to be that person. And so I was invited by Gray Area. They call themselves an art and culture incubator. No, an art and tech. Sorry. But anyway, they do a bunch of things, but they're very tech oriented. They're based in San Francisco. And they offered me a commission to make a new work, a new multimedia, immersive, performative. That was the main word, performative work. And when they first asked me, I said, I don't do performance. And Wade Wallerstein, the curator, he said, I said performative. And avatars perform. And I was like, all right, I know exactly what I want to do, or almost exactly. I knew I wanted to tell this particular story, as I said. But the form, I thought I was going to do one of my usual machinimas. I thought I was going to have each of them tell their story, talking, you know, walking around the garden or something. And I wrote out this, I did my research. I consulted with my amazing cousin, Stephen McCumber, who has been growing a Three Sisters garden for decades. You know, I read some books. I did, you know, looked on the internet, did some research, thought about it a lot. And I write my story. And I write out the storyboard and I go, this is going to be really boring. They're just standing there talking. I also had, when I proposed this project, I I really wanted to have the three avatars appear in front of the audience as in the flesh. So I put in there some, as part of the project, there would be three actresses or actors who would wear these superhero costumes and come out and interact in some way with the audience. And so when I came to this slight crisis that my machinima wasn't going to be very good, I had to, you know, I wanted to rethink it. And I did. And I thought, Scavenotti, you know, what do you want to make? What would excite you to make? And I've been wanting to make a music video in machinima, and I've been wanting to do a runway show of the three sisters' costumes. Because in the story, as they tell their story, they're moving through time and they have different outfits that kind of reflect that time. And so what I ended up doing was turning the story, taking my script and crossing out all the extraneous stuff and making it rhyme, and it became a rap song. And so I filmed it as a music video with them as not only superheroes, but also rap stars. And then at the end, instead of just three actors, there are 12 beautiful models who come out wearing each of the outfits and show and, you know, and have that sort of part of the cyber or the imagined becoming real. That's like my new thing of like, how can we make this future more present? You know, my older stories, like you saw Time Traveler TM or The Peacemaker Returns, they take place in centuries. And so when I talk about the eras represented in this story, I say pre-contact, colonization, genetic modification, and 5 minutes in the future. Very soon we will have this.
And speaking of the future, you have mentioned skins and your work with a younger generation of Aboriginal artists. And I would like to have more details, because I know how it is important for you and how it is important for Jason. I was meeting you and you were always telling me, well, the young people has to get the tools, and yet it is important, and video game is important. And it was really something you wanted to work on, and now it seems to work very well. So I would like you to tell us more about this fantastic story.
Oh, there's so much to say. First of all, I want to say that youth are the true future. Like, that's just clear. We have a website. People should go take a look at that. I actually cannot remember the URL, but Alexandra, you've been so amazing at finding stuff. It's definitely available through the Abtech website that you were on earlier. We offer a number of workshops. It's like we're nonprofit, eh? It's part of Concordia's, like we're underneath Concordia's big umbrella. But, and also because we've developed these curricula through the university, they are free and available to the public. Like if some teacher wanted to take our curriculum and use it in the class, that's absolutely no problem. But we have a lot of expertise in teaching Indigenous youth now. And so we, when invited, we do go. So we have three main categories, I guess you can say. The first one is the 7th Gen character design workshops. All of our workshops can like shrink or grow according to the amount of time the host has. Like sometimes, you know, Dawson down the street, they want a 2-hour workshop. So this 7th Gen character design workshop is like very easy. Like we can do that in 2 hours. We just use pencil and paper and we guide them through creating a character that lives in 7 generations from now. But sometimes someone from Nemeska wants us to come up for the whole week. And so we can still do that project, that workshop, but we expand it so that we can bring it into Second Life, and they first draw the character, but then in Second Life they modify an avatar to look like that character. And sometimes we end up taking a portrait. Sometimes we go all the way into doing a machinima, depending on the amount of time we have and what they would like to do. The video game workshops, we have new video games. We, you know, Bitsy and Twine are 2D and text-based workshops that, they're 2D and text-based software, I guess, that we can also do sort of shorter machinimo, We can do shorter workshops with those, but we can use Unity to create, you know, and Blender and all these other software to create a real, what I'm saying real, but, you know, what people, a 3D interactive video game that people imagine when you say video games. And then machinima workshops, we can teach people what I do. And soon we will have an AI workshop that we're working towards.
I think I need that workshop.
Yeah?
Because I'm starting to use ChatGPT.
Yes.
For doing texts, and then I send to my colleague Andre to make the corrections.
Well, I change everything.
Yeah. Well, that's I mean, one of the tricky things is we don't recruit. It's not tricky. I just mean we don't do the recruiting. We like to work with an organization that either, you know, already has students like the Ganawage Education Center, for example, you know, or is willing to recruit. So sometimes galleries have invited us and like, yeah, because we don't know, you know, and we don't, you know, Regina, the Mackenzie Gallery, like we don't know that population. So we're not going to recruit and we don't have the resources to do that. So we're spending our resources on developing the curriculum and finding instructors and making sure we know the programs very well so that we can teach it.
But Alexandre, you can start a group in Manwan and invite Skawenati to give the workshop the workshops.
Sure. You can do that. Or, you know, I mean, there's Andre, I'm forgetting the name, but you know what I mean when I say the Native Friendship Center. There's two.
Oui, the other one. Centre d'amitié.
Yeah, you know, those are, I mean, anyway, that's possible. Like, you know, there's. Yeah, it's true. If there's a group of people, if you have a group of just even five people, that could be, we could work something out.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that I know some people that would be interested for that.
Yes, we have to spread the word and expand these fantastic facilities to many Aboriginal would-be artists that will take us not 5 minutes, but forever in the future. I think that's it for today. Do you have something you would like to add, Skavenetti?
Oh, no, just thank you for the wonderful conversation. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Oh, I guess, you know, a little plug for Daphne. But I don't know if you have to have a podcast with me or someone else from our crew, but very happy to be a co-founder of the Montreal's first Indigenous Artist-Run Center, Daphne.
Yes, and they are our neighbor. We are in the same neighborhood. They are just the street beside us. So, yeah. So there is a lot of activities in Daphne with Aboriginal artists, and this is a place to visit. And you may even encounter Alexandre or me on the street. So
awesome.
Thank you very, very much, Skavenetti. It was a wonderful moment to go through this incredible experience you had as a human being, an artist, a Mohawk woman. All of this blend together create all this fantastic works that certainly make us our pace to the future more happy.
Nyawakoa, Andre.
Miigwetch, Skawenati, thank you. And just to tell our listeners with only audio part who can't see us, I've posted on the links, all the links of what you talk about during the podcast. You can see the link or the links to our a comment section of Facebook page.
Awesome. Thank you, Alexandre. It was nice to meet you.
Yeah, me too.
And everybody, we have our meeting on Adadegan Street each Wednesday at noon. So see you next week.
Yeah, see you next week. Matashi.
Bye. Matashi.
Anna.